The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.
With me is Conor Pope, Irish Times consumer affairs editor, Sean O'Rourke, Insights podcaster. And I believe there's a new series of Insights on the way.
Before another one being recorded next week, we're going to release them to an expectant Irish public probably in the next 2 to 3 weeks.
And
watch this space.
We have Noreen O'Sullivan, former Garda commissioner and, of course, former director of security at the UN. And it is on with Noreen we will start, because we were talking to Larry Donnelly about the sort of political impact and the public impact to that shooting in Minnesota. But could you give us your take on the policing side of things? Because there's now a dispute as to whether or not what the man was carrying was a legally held gun or whether it was his phone and there was no gun involved. But either way, there is no question that he drew his gun. There is no question that he attempted to shoot ICE agents, and he's now dead, having been shot thrice.
Well, I think, first of all, Anton, what we have to think is about the public imagery, but particularly for the community in the area that this is happening, just on the back of the shooting of Renee Good and the trust and the confidence that is there. And there is dispute at the moment, as we've all heard playing out in the on the airwaves and in print media, between the local police chief, Brian O'Hara, and indeed the ICE and federal agents, as regards who has primacy over investigating these killings, both killings now. And when you look at the video, certainly from an Irish and European context, you know, in the European context, you have Article 2 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which guarantees the right to life. And when life is taken, then it has to be independently investigated. So if I look across any other agency across Europe, or indeed here in Ireland, if such an event happens, and indeed, as you will have seen in the coroner's court at the moment, there's an ongoing inquest into the death of George Nkensho. But these things have to be investigated fairly and impartially and independently. And that's as much to maintain trust and confidence in the law enforcement authority, and I suppose to reassure the community as well that there is control. But what you see playing out on the face of it in Minnesota at the moment is absolute chaos on the streets. And, you know, looking at the moment, there's going to be a massive weather alerts all over, 2,400 kilometres. Yet such is the, I suppose, the sense and the sense of wrong that people are out protesting despite the really bad weather conditions. So you are kind of creating a terrible divide in the community. And this is a 37-year-old man who works as an intensive care nurse, who by reports it appears that he had a right to bear arms, which is his right in the United States. But there is no indication at this point in time from anything that I've seen or read or heard that he did withdraw his weapon. But even if he did, there's actually de-escalation tactics. And what you see is a number of officers actually tackle him to the ground. I think at one stage, trying to count the officers, there's up to 8 officers are tackling him to the ground, which again, you have to take it in the context, as I say, of the European Charter, indeed the UN Charter, in, as regards the right to life and the de-escalation, the proportionality and the necessity.
But I assume, shorn of diplomacy, if that was an Irish situation and you were commissioner and you were given the video of the ERU or the armed response guys, A, assaulting, and then B, shooting somebody when there are 8 of them, surely you'd have to say that's an utterly inappropriate response, disproportionate for use of force.
Well, the very first thing you would do is refer to the independent authority who would investigate it. And also, even in terms of, I go back to the Renee Good shooting, which there's more video footage available, even the preservation of the scene, for example, that it's handed over to the appropriate authority to investigate. And we see this even at protests across Europe. You know, there's independent investigations in relation to the proportionality and the necessity. So actually, there's a lot of things, but I have had the experience during the President Obama's presidency, actually, the Guardian versus Warrior debate in the United States. And actually, you know, we were asked actually as Ireland to go and talk to police chiefs in the United States as regards the de-escalation tactics and how people can be engaged and how we as an unarmed police force can manage some of these very volatile, very dangerous situations. So I have had that experience of actually being able to talk directly to police chiefs in the United States. And interestingly, yesterday, 2 of them, Charlie Ramsey, and who was the former commissioner of the Chicago Police, and who was the former commissioner of Boston Police, and they were both commenting actually on their view of the video as it was playing out, but very, very quickly after. So it would be very interesting to see whether or not, you know, listening to Ed Davis and Charlie Ramsey yesterday, how it will play out across, but what will the federal government do about it as well, as terms of investigation and accountability?
Well, so far it looks like, I mean, if J.D. Vance is anything to go by, the federal government is going to leave it well enough alone, seems
well,
to be.
Well, I think what's really important there is, like, at the prior shooting, Renee Good, there was talk about immunity for some of these people. Actually, you know, again, back to accountability, there has to be demonstrable accountability to maintain trust and confidence in organisations.
What about the wider sort of setting that all of this is happening in, Sean? The vista of masked, armed federal agents walking around US cities and demanding papers and now killing two innocent US civilians.
Yes, we spent a lot of time in the last week, for very understandable reasons, looking at what was happening in Davos and Donald Trump threatening to take over Greenland by force if necessary, imposing sanctions or increased tariffs on eight countries that were disagreeing with him, and speaking down and talking down to European leaders. I mean, taking the total piss out of Emmanuel Macron in his rambling speech. But in actual fact, and no matter how serious that is, and even though he walked it back, people talked about a wake-up call. What's actually happening in the United States looks to me like it's far more serious than what we're witnessing perhaps internationally. You have something like 3,000 ICE agents descending on St. Paul and Minneapolis from various parts of the United States and causing chaos, it would appear, and killing two people so far. And at the same time, you've got thousands of people coming out to protest silently. I mean, the situation as described by Noreen, and also listening to Larry Donnelly earlier talking about the appalling vista, and that it most certainly is. You know, wondering, I mean, you have, for instance, the President of the United States overnight accusing the mayor, Jack Frey, I think is his name, Jake Frey, and the governor, Tim Walz, of inciting insurrection. And saying, let our people, let our ICE people do their job. I mean, where is this going to somehow be got to de-escalate? Because you have the local police basically prevented from going in the immediate aftermath of this shooting to investigate. So I think it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Well, that was even interesting in the first Minnesota killing. Not just were the local police prevented from going in, but medics were prevented from attending to the victim who was simply left in the car to expire.
Yeah. And not to mention the total denial on the part of the authorities, by which I mean the federal authorities and the president and his people, that there was anything to account for. It was basically these people getting in the way of the ICE agents doing their job.
To some extent, though, Connor, is this what the people voted for? Because the Trump administration made very clear in the run-up to the election that there would be the largest deportation in the history of the US, that that's where they were going to start and that's what they're delivering.
I don't think the Republicans, even the MAGA army, voted for public executions, and effectively that's what we're seeing here. And I think that's a really important point. And I know that it's a cliche that's often trotted out about the Orwellian thing about, you know, reject the evidence of your eyes and ears, and that's the most essential command. And that's what we're being asked to do here, because Kristi Noem came out overnight and she's lying, and we all know she's lying. J.D. Vance is lying. Donald Trump is lying. All of these people are lying to the American people, and they're lying to the world. And, you know, that lie has an impact, because I actually last night I was just on my phone mindlessly scrolling, as you do, and I saw the first video coming out coming onto my Instagram timeline of the shooting, the murder of this man, and I was horrified, because you could see clearly that he was there with one hand held in the air. The other hand was holding a phone. The ICE agents pushed this woman really aggressively to the ground. He kind of stepped in to try and protect her, and they maced him or pepper sprayed him from about an inch into his eyes. And then eight of them, roughly, jumped on him. And then 2 seconds later, he shot. And I was horrified. And then I saw the Kristi Noem comments that he was an armed person. And for about an hour, I thought, like, what, was he armed? And I started to disbelieve the evidence of my eyes, because the Department of Homeland Security, the federal agencies were saying this man was armed. And I thought, maybe he was armed. Maybe I didn't see it. But I have now watched the same video from countless angles, and it's horrific. Like, it's awful, because you're watching a person being killed. It's this, and clearly, the state, the US state, is telling its people lies. And to go back to your question, Anton, that is not what hardworking, decent Republicans have voted for. And what I can't understand is why these people are standing for it. Why is it only the so-called left who are protesting these things, because every single decent American should be on the streets this week, next week, calling for the end of the Trump regime. And it's awful to be saying that, because the American idea is something that we have been allied to for generations, but it's being absolutely betrayed.
But will they not say unintended consequences of something that we want to occur anyway, that there are omelets and eggs, that you can't do the kind of mass deportations in the face of protest?
They shot Rene Good in the face. They shot this man who was completely defenseless, and they killed him. These are not unintended consequences. This is the result of poorly trained people given carte blanche to do whatever they want on the streets of America.
Can I pick up on the issue of training with you, Nornie O'Sullivan? Because one of the things that I'm intrigued by is because there has been a big recruitment drive, the type of people who decide they want to work for ICE, I imagine, is a fairly self-selecting demographic. It is a certain type who is going to want to be a masked federal agent, armed, dragging people out of their homes. The level of training that they are getting compared to, let's say, an armed response unit in Ireland or the ERU, is it in any way comparable?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that we don't know, Anton. We don't know how these people are actually brought together, what their formation is. It's very unclear, certainly, what the governance structures around them, where the accountability structures are. You know, again, you read some reports that some of them are ex-military, some are ex-police, but actually the standards for bringing people in, it's almost impossible to know from this remove. And I'm not sure that anybody really understands it. But I think picking up on one of Connor's points is that, and your question, is this what the American people voted for? I think where all of this chaos is going on, yes, deportations are a part of it. But actually then when you see again the dystopian view of a five-year-old child in a bunny hat being used as bait to bring his father out so that he and his father could be detained. Like that.
For those who didn't see, this is ICE agents taking a small child to the front door to try to get the father to answer the door so that they could arrest him.
Yes, and that's what's reported. And if that's the case, you know, again, where does the balance come into that? And is this what people actually vote for? But while all of this chaos is playing out, as Connor has said, in front of our very eyes, at the same time, the ordinary citizens, we all have American friends who are living and working in the United States on all sides of the political divide. But actually, they're still suffering from the price of inflation, the cost of living, all of the uncertainty around, you know, again, I bring in this big freeze, the cost of electricity, the cost of gasoline has just risen exponentially. And you have all of these people who are really, really concerned about all of these things. And yet all of this chaos is going on. As Sean has said, then you have the background of Davos and all this geopolitical threats and counter threats been played out. So what does this mean for the real people, the voters, the American voters? And how will it play out in the midterm elections?
But I think it's really worth pointing out here, because Trump has lied about all of those things as well. According to Trump, gasoline prices are at their lowest level ever. According to Trump, egg prices have plummeted. And I think one of the, we were all tying ourselves up in knots earlier in the week with the threats of tariffs and Trump's threat to invade Greenland. So just to see what was going on, I went on to the US Pravda, Fox News, and I looked at their website, and the Greenland story was ranked 29th on its website last Tuesday, when it was the headline news in every single newspaper in Europe. Fox News had decided it was the 29th most important story to be covering. And I think when you consider how many Americans are getting their news from Fox News and from Breitbart and from Newsmax and from all of these horrendous news organizations that have no sense of truth, that also feeds into the problem, because these people simply aren't being told what we're being told.
That the other thing that happens is it's to some extent it sort of bends time, because you mentioned Davos. Davos feels like it happened a year and a half ago, and it was 3 days ago. What was your take, Sean, again on the bizarre situation of having the Canadian Prime Minister effectively say that non-superpowers but significant powers of the world need to coalesce against the Americans?
Well, I suppose it was maybe a statement of the obvious, and he was one of the people who, if you like, didn't fit into the Bill Gates observation that, you know, a lot of people are afraid to speak out about how they're afraid to speak out. And for his troubles, I think Carney has now, in the last couple of days or 48 hours, been threatened with a 100% increase in tariffs on Canada if he does a deal with China.
And he's been uninvited from the Board of Peace.
Indeed. But I thought one of the interesting things that happened in the course of the week in Davos was the way Trump backed away from taking Greenland, and, you know, he removed the threat of tariffs. And he seems, a lot of attention has focused on Mark Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO, who seems to be the one person who can talk him down. Now, it seems to be that he's a kind of a NATO version of Bertie Ahern. He can handle and defuse any situation, right? He is somebody who held together over the space of 12 years, something like four disparate coalitions in the Netherlands, including one which had a confidence and supply deal with your man Geert Wilders of the outer regions of the right. And it seems that his modus operandi is to use what was described to me as industrial grade charm. Sorry, it was what I read in one of the papers, not described, well, it was by the writer, I suppose. And his approach is to stay below the surface. It's a submarine approach, right? Stay below the surface, don't make waves, and only come up when you absolutely need to. And you have a particular purpose of getting something done. So, I mean, he's got it in the neck for referring to Trump as daddy, and you know, in this tweet or text he sent him saying, "I can't wait to see you." It's almost like kind of a lover's message or something like that. But hey, it seems to work.
Well, although a little bit, because there was an analysis in one of the papers today that said that the NATO view is that there are 3 years left in Donald Trump's term, and in the overall duration of the alliance, that is but a drop in the water. So let's simply wait until this ends. Are they betting that it gets better when he goes?
Well, they possibly are. But the question is, what happened? Given what's happened in the last 3 weeks, not to mind the next 3 years. You know, how much, you know, how safe is your bet in saying we can hold everything together? Because I think as one columnist I read over the weekend was suggesting that, look, you know, one of these days, one of these bombs that Trump plants is going to go off and not be defused.
Well, there's an interesting bit on that, Connor, that I don't know if you saw it, but there was an analysis of what is now being not referred to abusively, but just simply as a paradigm, the TACO phase, where Trump always chickens out. He says something that horrifies the markets react, he sees it, and then he backs off. And the analyst was saying that at a certain point, the markets will stop doing it because it'll get baked in, and then the madness will get worse and worse. It's extraordinary that the entire global financial markets now have to look and say, is this real or is he making it up?
Yeah, and that's, I think, what drives Trump. It's what's happening to the markets. And I think it's not that the Europeans stood up to Trump over his Greenland threats at Davos. It's the fact that the bond markets in the US started to weaken. It's the fact that the stock exchange started to weaken. And that's what terrifies him, because he's so singular about these kinds of things. So for Trump, ultimately, it's money that talks. And you're right, maybe the markets will start to bake in the craziness at some point and then there will be less volatility. But for now, that's basically the only barrier we have between the world just falling apart. And I think it's really interesting that, you know, an awful lot of commentators are saying earlier in the week that what Trump has succeeded in doing in the last 3 weeks has been something that the Russians and before Russia, the USSR, had been trying to do for 70 years, which was to fragment NATO and destabilize Europe. And he did that successfully for a period, and then he of course rolled back, but the damage is still done.
On the other hand, you can point to what one of Trump's achievements is, and that is that to wake up NATO to start paying their way, the members of it. And he says, oh, they're up to 5%. No, they're not. They have set themselves a target of 5%. They're heading in, and that mightn't happen for another 10 or 12 years. And the other thing he has done, I mean, we can you know, scorn the idea of the Board of Peace, and you know
we can
and should perhaps.
Vladimir Putin and Benjamin Netanyahu are invited to join the Board of Peace. I think we can scorn it
absolutely.
And reportedly, 14 countries that wouldn't get passports for America.
He did engineer a situation where the remaining hostages, were released back to Israel. Virtually all of the bodies were returned. Now you can say, What did the Board of Peace start as? It started as a way of reviving Gaza, however far-fetched that might seem to be when you hear his son-in-law saying it can be done in 3 years, we can start getting it rebuilt and he can produce these fancy images of what it'll look like. I mean, it's off the wall.
Actually, but I also think, you mentioned the Board of Peace, and I think in the 1970s when Henry Kissinger won the Nobel Prize, the famous quote was, "Irony died." that day. I think irony's corpse was dug up and it died again when Trump formulated this board of peace. Because it's a nonsense, Sean.
Well, it's a way of attacking the United Nations. I mean, it's effectively being held out as an alternative or a replacement for the UN.
Of course it is.
And again, you could say that the UN has a lot of faults and he is, if you like, piggybacking on that in a way of saying, well, look, you know, I don't like the way the escalator didn't work, or I don't like the way the autocue didn't work when I went to address them. And they were all laughing at me.
You should pay $1 billion to join. They can sack, they can dump you from the board at a moment's notice.
No, he can.
And
he can designate his successor as well.
The president is going to be the chairperson.
There's shades of Idi Amin about this.
In another context, it would be laughable.
But also, we should be reminded of Mark Carney's speech as well. And back to the question about strategy. Neither nostalgia or hope is a strategy. And isn't it absolutely ridiculous? And we're in the realms of ridiculous when we're talking about international policy in terms of and the international markets in terms of TACO and FAFO. And in all of this going on, we're not even thinking about what happened in Venezuela and the fact that another leader of a sovereign country is actually incarcerated in the US, whether he's a good person or a bad person.
He's going to appear before the courts in New York on the 17th of March. Now, does that remind us of any other event?
Yeah, of course. And not only that, not only do we now have to face the prospect of Micheál Martin visiting Donald Trump, but reports today are saying that we're going to have a visit because when the Irish Open is on towards the end of the year and we have the European presidency, he's going to arrive over to Doon Beg and put us right at the heart of all this. We will talk more about this after the break. Now, before the break, we were talking about the prospect of visitation. 17th of March, Taoiseach heading out with his bowl of greenery to the US president, and also the prospect that the US president is going to come to Doon Beg for the Irish Open. How politically dangerous is any of that for Micheál Martin? Does it matter in the big scheme of things?
Well, it's very interesting, and Shane Ross highlights this quite acutely and astutely in his Sunday Independent column today, the different approaches being taken, for instance, by Simon Harris, the Taoiseach, and Micheál Martin, the Taoiseach, for instance, in regard to the Board of Peace. Micheál Martin effectively kind of leaving the door open, but not ruling it out, and saying, well, we have concerns about it. That's kind of taking the European line. Simon Harris and the other saying, you must be joking. I mean, like, the idea of something with the words peace and Putin in it is something of an oxymoron, and saying, not a chance of paying all this money. And it's easy for him to say that. He doesn't have to go to the White House on Patrick's Day or sometime, assuming the invitation comes through.
If ever there's a day you're glad you're not T-shirt.
And, I mean, he might have a different view, you know, if the roles were reversed. But I don't know if it reflects a difference in government or any kind of a policy difference, but it shows that maybe the Taoiseach has a bit more freedom of speech, and the chances are Micheál Martin agrees with him but can't say it.
And do you think there is any appetite, either in Ireland or across Europe, for the growing of a spine? I mean, we saw Christine Lagarde storm out of a meeting, we are told, during the week because of the way that the US Commerce Secretary was
at the dinner,
Is there now becoming an appetite for that? Keir Starmer was fairly aggressive about what was said about UK troops. So was Giorgia Meloni about the Italian troops. Is there a public desire for somebody to stand up to the US?
Well, yes, and it's there on a collective way now. I mean, I think we saw it with the way Starmer objected to what he said. Well, and for very obvious reasons. How could he not? But
we've had capitulation before when you could have prefaced it with how could they not. There's been an awful lot of direct insults that the UK or the EU politicians
European leaders have taken the view, no more Mr. Nice Guy. And we're going to hit back when it needs to be, when that needs to happen. But whether there's any particular point in Micheál Martin poking the bear, as it were, unnecessarily. He doesn't have, like, Trump hasn't said anything specific about Ireland that needs a direct response on the base that he has insulted us, say, a la Churchill, you know, after the Second World War, and De Valera, you know, had to come forward with that monumental riposte. So, you know, I think Micheál Martin is on this tightrope, and I think it's, you know, I think it's a pretty sensible approach to take.
Text saying, I think all of you forget that the majority of Trump supporters don't watch the news at all. They believe everything he says to them and believe the cost of living will go down. It is a matter of time. Another, Anton, no way should Shamrock be presented to Trump. It is about unity, peace and love, of which the current US president knows nothing.
The visit to Doon Beg is a much bigger headache, I suspect, than the visit to the White House.
Because we'll have the presidency.
Yes. But not just we'll have the presidency. I mean, we'll have perhaps thousands of people heading there, not to watch the golf, but to shout and roar at this man. And so Noreen's successors in An Garda Síochána are going to have a big task in managing that.
Will we see thousands seeing? Will people go and protest?
I think it's quite likely in the current vein of things that we will see protests. But one way or the other, the security for a European presidency is monumental anyway. And then there that were visits. It's not that we haven't seen this before. We did have visits of the US president before, along with the Queen at various times. So actually Ireland's well equipped to deal with that. But I think this is a very different context. And I also think this is where I agree with Sean. I think it's walking the tightrope of diplomacy. But actually, it's where the art of diplomacy and the art of the deal may conflate or collide. Because at the end of the day, if we look at Eric Trump's article today and the vision for what Doombeg will be and how, if planning permission would allow it, we could build maybe a massive, big, beautiful ballroom in the middle of O'Connell Street. But if you look at this vision,
just to clarify, this is Eric Trump, who was interviewed at Doombeg, who said that they want to expand Doombeg, and he's giving out about Ireland's planning laws because he'd love to see a Trump Tower in Dublin.
And Scotland and Ireland. So maybe we're being conflated as well. And I suppose, when you look at it and you think about what does it mean from the security implications, but also then from the diplomatic implications of actually the president either inviting himself or indeed being extended an invite when the Bowl of Shamrock has been passed over. And how is that managed diplomatically? And back to that thing of having a foreign policy strategy and having a very determined objectives in terms of how that's done. But also, I think, explaining to not just the Irish public, but the public generally around what is needed here and why it's been done. Because I think a lot of people will look at this very confused and very upset by some of the things that we've seen playing out, as we've discussed earlier.
Maybe we could see Donald Trump on your podcast, Sean.
Well, it would be the second time he and I would engage in conversation.
I know.
We'd have a live interview in Doombeg in 2014, which I think is probably still up on the
I think we should all go and listen to it.
And when he was elected president, actually, we re-ran it in, was it 2016? And it actually sounded okay listening back.
He didn't think it was okay.
And after he called you what, Sean?
Well, no, I'm in polite company. I mean, I did use one slightly impolite phrase earlier on referring to what he said about Mr. Macron. So, look, he
began with an A and ended with an E.
It did. There was a double S there in the middle.
Let's look at issues domestically, because there's a poll in the Sunday Business Post. You can almost feel Micheál Martin's ire rising, because we know how much he enjoys opinion polls. It shows Fianna Fáil at 15%. You referenced De Valera a little bit earlier on, Sean. He is spinning in his grave, I would have thought, at numbers like that. 15% for Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael at 18%, and Sinn Féin roaring away at 24%.
Yeah, they still managed 17% in the 2011 election, which was their lowest of all time in the actual election. But Micheál Martin, and it's pointed out by various people, including Shane Coleman and Richard Caldwell in the Business Post this morning, that, look, they were at a similar level in 2024 around this time. And yet before the summer arrived, well, they did pretty well in the local elections. And then they had 22% in the general election. They became the biggest party in the Dáil. They got back in to lead the government. So, I think if we weren't heading into the European presidency, I think there's every chance the skids would be under Micheál Martin at this stage. But it's kind of, hit me now with the EU in my arms, as it were. And also the one obvious candidate to replace him, Jim McCallum, isn't showing any signs of wanting to force the issue. It's almost as though he and his supporters can say, look, it's coming his way anyway.
Make me pious, but just not yet.
Exactly. Or, let Micheál have. And it's also the centenary of the foundation of Fianna Fáil, 2026. So do they really want a big family fight, in a year when they should be and can be celebrating, the achievements of the party and maybe glossing over some of the lesser moments in the party's history? So, I mean, I don't think there's any particular reason to think that there will be an early heave or anything like that. You never know in politics. But, there's a very narrow window between now and the 1st of July.
In your analysis, do you think that the party will view that the doldrums in which they are dwelling in the polls is directly Micheál Martin's fault? Will they see him as culpable?
Well, it's certainly a big part of it if you go back to the debacle of the presidential election. Also, there's a fact that he's there so long. I mean, he has been a prominent figure in the party going back to, he was a minister in 1997, He's also done the party and the state some service by, I mean, when others were scattering into the middle distance and giving up their careers, Micheál Martin stood and led the party, you know, into the tornado that was that election, and he did haul it back. So I think they will give him some credit for that. But there is a sense that, look, you know, he's coming to the end of his time. Thanks very much, Micheál. Time to go. I mean, it's not a magic formula, as Fine Gael have discovered more than once, changing the leader. It doesn't always work. In fact, oftentimes the last state of affairs is often worse than the first. So I think the notion, as he said, that he wants to lead the party into the next election, well, you can forget about that, I think. I would have a doubt as to whether he can stay much longer than the duration of the presidency. This time next year, okay, you'll say he'll be in the run in to handing over in November of that year to Simon Harris. You know, assuming everything is the same, other things being equal, and he may decide himself. I don't know.
We were talking earlier about the situation in the States, and we were talking about the situation in Europe and the interaction too. If you have any questions or comments on either, Simon Coveney, former Minister for Defence, and former Taoiseach, is going to be with us just after the news, so you can fire them into 53106 or 087 1400 106. We do need to move to the issue that I know has been at the focus of most of the panel's attention for the last number of days, which is the fallout between Brooklyn Beckham and his parents, David and Victoria. A double page spread in the Mail, the second double page spread in the Mail this weekend. Saturday's edition also had a double page spread. This time, Victoria is letting it be known through sources that she did nothing wrong at this wedding dance, and effectively Brooklyn needs to wind his neck on. Have any of you been paying any attention to this, or does it bore you senseless?
My wife was paying very close attention to it, and we were watching a TV programme last Tuesday or Wednesday night, and we had to stop everything. It was like remember the news flashes from times past? It was like a news flash. And she said, oh my God, you have no idea what's just happened. Brooklyn Beckham has issued a statement. And then she read the full six pages of the statement to me, and I found myself listening. On so many levels, it's absurd. But then on another, like, kind of human level, it's really sad when parents fall out with their children, or when children fall out with their parents, which is kind of what has happened here. But then, of course, you have all the memes and all the jokes about Victoria's dancing and all that stuff. And so, like, it's a silly story that we really shouldn't be talking about. The world shouldn't care about this.
It's probably
story.
In the top three most read stories in the Irish Times, as it was in the Guardian.
undoubtedly.
Because it's a bit like people watching the famous wedding of Charles and Diana back in the day.
Undoubtedly. And it is, we do have this, like, obsession with celebrity, and we love it when celebrities fall out, and we love it when famous. But, like, I kind of feel sorry for Brooklyn, because his dad was supremely talented. And I say that as a Manchester United supporter, so I've long had a lot of time for David Beckham. His mother was very talented as a designer. She was in the Spice Girls. Brooklyn.
Don't forget Sir Alex threw a football boot at David Beckham.
Who was that famous politician who said, was it Pat Rabbit who said, talent skips a generation?
It was Pat Rabbit.
And clearly, the talent.
Say it about to
I'm not going to say.
Apparently, there's no such thing as bad publicity, because it is a very human story. But apparently, Victoria has shot up to number one again in some of the charts with one of her songs.
One of her solo hits. Not even with the Spice Girls.
So apparently, there's no. But I do think, from a human level, you know, it is a tragic thing of a family. But actually, with everything that's happening in the world, can we really think about it? And actually, I don't share Connor's view of feeling sorry for Brooklyn. I just read something the other day that was reported that actually one of the examples he gave of how badly he was treated was when his parents were both too busy to pick him up from some football game or something, and he had to travel on public transport.
Oh, the humanity.
God help him. But I do empathise with him, or my sons would empathise with him, about his mother showing him too much affection in public, because I have three sons. I think they would probably share his view that actually it's probably a bit much to be shown too much affection.
In that piece that you referred to, Anton, in the Mail, I think it was referenced made of the fact that David kisses all his sons, you know, when they come home. And I mean, like, I think the youngest is 14, the others are in 20 and 23 or thereabouts. Now, I've got four sons, but I don't kiss them when I see them.
I will not hear a word against David Beckham. I will not hear a word against David Beckham. Let me go back to my original position. No, David Beckham.
I might give him an odd hug, but, you know, it's been some manly thing to do.
Here,
you know?
Now, what I. This sympathy that we are for, is this not, you know, that great line in the movie A Few Good Men, where Jack Nicholson says, "You live under the blanket of freedom that I provide and you question the method in which I provide it." Is that not at the heart of Brooklyn Beckham? The man has had every opportunity. He has been gifted a life of luxury his entire
existence. I'm interrupting you there for a second, because, like, you're talking there about money, right? And all of the
too
comfort.
Too much affection, Connor. Yeah, no, they're too affectionate with
but
me.
But he is all, and like, to be serious for a second, he has been monetized since he was in the womb.
That's a fair
like
point.
His family were selling pictures of like their ultrasound scans and the pregnancy and then his birth and then his life. And it's like, it must be absolutely wearying for a young man to go through that kind of stuff, because Brand Beckham has been absolutely to the fore for his entire life. And I'd say at some point he was just going, Jesus, enough, lads. I just want to live my
but
life.
He does the same, surely. I mean, wasn't he largely monetizing his own wedding?
And is he now
no, I think his family.
House.
See, I think he married into a family.
Nicola Peltz,
his, Nicola Peltz's dad, who sounds like a terrible human being.
I think he'd be better off taking a leaf out of the Trump children's approach to life. Actually, I mean, I watched them in Doonbeg the night before that reference that interview referenced earlier, and there was a great. It was obvious to me there was a great rapport, affection, and loyalty there. And
was there? I was never that sure. That was
the clear impression. I mean, you can criticize Donald Trump on so many levels, but and maybe they know where their bread is buttered. That could be an element of it too. But I just thought there was an ease of relationship and relaxation about it. So,
but the other kids seem.
And
to
I'm
be.
Sure there are things he does that probably drive them around the bend from time to time, maybe even embarrasses them. But, you know, there is that sense of family unity and family loyalty.
But also, I think the sense of one voice, because again, if you look at Eric Trump's interview today, you know, he is speaking on behalf of his father and how his father sees
and
the
I think
world.
A lot of Irish politicians would actually agree with Eric Trump about the length of time it takes to achieve things in this country.
That's true.
So when do they, what's the, not rehabilitate, what's the word I'm looking for when you get
reconciled?
Back? Thank you very much, John. That's what made you the broadcaster you are. The fact that words come to you instead of just disappearing out of your head like me.
Except when I sometimes forget the name of the leaders of the DUP and a sports broadcaster from this parish has to come to my assistance. But that's another day's work. Look, it's going to take time. There's a parallel as well with the situation between King Charles and Harry. And, you know, they say time is a great healer. And maybe a period of silence now would be appropriate for them. And just let things calm down.
And reflection.
And actually, yes. David Beckham did handle it quite well. Yeah. Because, I mean, he didn't make any comment. He was at Davos, funnily enough. He didn't make any comment. Mm. But he just said, you know, sometimes children make mistakes. And he's right. Mm. We all make mistakes.
And sometimes parents make mistakes.
Indeed. We're all human.
And as the Queen would say as well, the late Queen Elizabeth, recollections may vary about that dance.
Well, on this wonderful note of consensus and positivity, text say, the Beckham should have protected the children's privacy. You reap what you sow. No one hears anything about the Clooney twins. We don't see pictures of them plastered all over the place. As a result, they'll be able to live relatively normal lives. And a lot of people texting along these lines, I've never in my 58 years protested, but I'll be in Doonbeg protesting, and I think there will be thousands with me. Big thank you to Noreen O'Sullivan, to Connor Pope, and to Sean O'Rourke. Don't forget, you can hunt down the Insights podcast anywhere you get your podcast.
Starting with the RTE platform.
And can we also wish Anton the best of luck on his new program in the morning.
Thank you very much.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.